Tropical Storm Elsa impacts the search and rescue efforts underway in Surfside. Hello and welcome to Sundial. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The storm is bringing strong winds and lots of rain to Key West and the Lower Keys, and it's expected to bring nasty weather to the rest of South Florida. We have updates from a meteorologist and hear about its impact on Surfside. Plus, more lawsuits are being filed after the Surfside collapse. We talk with a construction attorney about the process of filing suit and what changes could come. Finally, a young man has been maintaining the memorial wall at the Surfside collapse, coordinating fresh flowers and visiting almost daily. He joins us to talk about why he's driven to spend his time helping people. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Tropical Storm Elsa is causing winds, rain, and storms across the Keys, especially in Key West. Summer school is closed, and a special meeting about cruise ship regulations has been delayed. West of the Keys, the storm is making its way around the Gulf of Mexico, threatening the Tampa area and Central Florida counties now. Megan Borowski is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, and she joins us now to talk about the known impacts from the storm so far and its potential impacts to come. Megan, what are the conditions in Key West and the Middle Keys?
Yeah, so right now we are dealing with rain bands from Elsa wrapping in through the Keys. Looks like we've got some heavy rainfall right now occurring just between Big Pine Key and Marathon, and that's just going to continue over the next couple of hours as this storm lifts farther northward. We have rainfall rates between 1 and 1.5 inches an hour. Also, gusts, latest wind gusts from Key West, about 52 miles an hour. Now, farther east, it's a little bit lower than that in the upper 30s, but still pretty gusty out there. We've got the heavy rainfall, though, really impacting the Keys.
And how do we expect the outer bands of this storm to impact our listeners on the mainland?
Elsa's center is going to continue lifting to the north-northwest tonight into tomorrow. So we're going to have that rain shield wrapping into South Florida really from now into the evening and the first part of the overnight. So expect rounds of heavy rainfall. We are looking at an uptick potentially in thunderstorm activity, gusty winds, tropical storm force gust extending inland, could be a bit higher than that directly along the coastline. And also, we are going to be on the east side of this storm. So as these bands wrap ashore, they're going to have a little bit of rotation, and that could help to spawn a few tornadoes as well. So winds, rain, and tornadoes, all possibilities this evening for South Florida.
Is this a typical tropical storm in terms of its shape and how it's formed?
Climatologically speaking, it's formed over the central part of the Atlantic. So I'm not seeing anything too unusual with it. Of course, each storm in and of itself is unique. We do have rainfall and rain amounts that are, it's a favoring the right side of the storm, but there's nothing, you know, blatantly unusual about Elsa.
And it's been moving west. It's threatening the state's west coast. What are you seeing, and how are you expecting the storm to behave once it gets past the Florida Keys?
Right. So actually, its motion right now is to the north-northwest at about 10 miles an hour. So it's really going to parallel the Florida Gulf coastline. Now, the core of the storm is expected to stay over the Gulf of Mexico. So we could see just a little bit of strengthening. You might see an uptick, a slight uptick in those maximum sustained winds over the next 24 hours or so. So Elsa will parallel the coast. We're going to see heavy rainfall moving up the Florida Peninsula tonight into tomorrow. We're expecting it to make a landfall anywhere between Cedar Key and maybe the Tampa area early on Wednesday morning. Then it should track to the north northeast over north central Florida, impacting Jacksonville, and then paralleling the Atlantic coast. So it's going to continue northward and then shift to the north northeast. Tropical storm force gusts, especially along the coastline, that's going to be a big factor. Also, those torrential rainfall rates, and those will combine to give us the potential for some power outages and downed trees, especially toward the Tampa area, the I-4 corridor.
And we've already had 5 named storms just so far this year, and it's only the beginning of July. Mm-hmm. Has this become the new norm?
Well, certainly we've had several years with above average activity. I can tell you that this particular year, the El Nino Southern Oscillation is in a neutral phase and it's tending to swing toward a La Nina phase. And we have noticed, climatologically speaking, that in those instances, you will have warmer than average sea surface temperatures. You'll have weaker trade winds and an enhanced monsoon, African monsoon, and all those can combine to give us an uptick in tropical cyclone activity. So because of those climatological factors, that could be one explanation for why we're seeing above average tropical cyclones.
I've been speaking with Megan Borowski, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to WLRN.org and All Things Considered for the latest on Tropical Storm Elsa. Our WLRN Monroe County reporter, Nan Klinginer, is following updates closely. She says as of this afternoon, there's been no major damages reported, but residents in the Lower Keys and Key West should avoid traveling outdoors. You can follow her on Twitter, at Key West Nan. On Sunday night, the 4th of July, emergency officials demolished what was left of the Champlain Towers South condo. They were working on a tight timeline because of Elsa's potential weather threats. Most of South Florida outside of the Keys wasn't severely impacted, but its rain and winds are still complicating the ongoing search and rescue efforts in Surfside. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero has been following the changes at the scene, and he joins us now. Danny, emergency officials really had to move quickly to get the rest of the building down before the storm came in. Why was it so necessary, and how did it get done?
Well, to answer the first part, it was necessary because the remaining structure was not very stable, and there was ongoing concerns about the potential that the remaining parts of the building could possibly collapse and endanger the search and rescue workers that were working on the scene. The construction did have to pause a couple times last week because of the observations that engineers and people on the scene were making about some columns shifting, some things in the remaining building shifting. So it was a concern even before Hurricane Elsa came into the picture. And then with Hurricane Elsa looming and the potential of a direct or very close indirect hit here in Miami-Dade County, there was extra concern about whether the remaining building could withstand that. So they chose the county and the state together chose to demolish the building, and they basically brought in an explosives expert, and he laid out over 100 pounds of dynamite across the site. And they did demolish the rest of the remaining building at about 10:30 on the 4th of July night. And, you know, according to what Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava has said, is that it went very smooth, and it was seamless, and basically only dust fell on the original site where there's still a search and rescue operation underway.
And for our listeners, I just want to reiterate that Elsa was a hurricane briefly, but it is a tropical storm now.
Right,
Danny.
Right.
There was a plea to Judge Michael Hansman to delay the destruction of the building because of pets that may still be in the building, in the rubble. Why did the judge ultimately deny the request?
Well, Judge, you know, I watched the hearing. He was not very happy having to make that kind of call, but he did decide that it was basically within the purview of the county government to make that kind of decision. He didn't want to overstep it. And also just the very straightforward risk that anyone going into that building would assume, especially the person that was making the request to go in was an animal rights volunteer, didn't live in the building, lived in Broward County. But there were reports throughout the days that there were remaining pets, you know, a couple cats, a dog, a couple birds. And, you know, the county did make efforts to find animals. They actually sent some people up in cranes. They went through closets. They went under beds looking for any signs of animals where they were told that they might be. And they said they did not find any signs of any animals while they were in there. So that we don't know if they potentially escaped, if they went somewhere else in the building, that they weren't able to find anyone, but we are told that they made many efforts to find any animals remaining in the building.
When, and going back to the storm, how are the outer bands of this wet rain we're seeing and some wind affecting the first responders who are searching through the rubble?
Right. Well, it's, you know, the weather really hasn't helped at all in any part of this search and rescue effort. You know, even back before there was a storm on our radar, there was heavy rains and whatnot from a typical Miami summer. And then now we are getting some outer bands. So last night they had to pause the efforts a couple times because of heavy rains, lightning, the winds were causing some of the cranes to actually move. So they have had to pause it, and they do have on the scene right now some weather experts that are monitoring things in real time. So if any of these strong bands come in, that they'll respond to that.
And it's the lightning that's causing a 30-minute delay every time that there's a strike within, I believe it's 2.5 miles of the site. Is that right?
That's right. And the wind is also a big concern, because there's cranes there that are working to pull up some of the bigger boulders and slabs in the rubble. But with, you know, we got wind gusts last night of almost 30 miles an hour. And some of it was sustained at points, and that was actually causing a lot of movement on that, which is a safety concern for everyone on the ground there.
Wow. Well, despite the weather, since the demolition Sunday night, we have seen the search and rescue team, you know, make progress at finding more people. How has this demolition changed their ability, these first responders' ability to actually get through the rubble?
Right. It has accelerated the efforts. There were some parts of the original rubble that were just very difficult to access because of these safety concerns, and the, you know, nobody was quite clear on how stable the rest of the remaining structure is. But those efforts have accelerated now that looming threat of the rest of the building coming down have gone away. They've kind of just been able to get in there more. And so the pace of the search and rescue has accelerated. You know, unfortunately, no one else has been found alive. We're up to 32 total recovered people, not all of whom have been identified yet. And there's 113 people who are potentially unaccounted for, which is a slight change in just the phrasing of it, potentially, because it's a fluid situation. The authorities are constantly reviewing and going back through and double checking that everyone that was originally reported as missing was indeed missing. So it is a little bit of a fluid situation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava, at a briefing this morning, she changed the language for the missing, and now she says there's about 70 people we can confirm were in the building at the time of the collapse. And then you have this number of the potentially unaccounted for, where they're not sure that these folks were in the building. Why are the numbers in the search and rescue effort evolving this way?
Well, we have to keep in mind that a lot of the information that authorities had initially gathered were from family members and from people that might not have been on the scene or in the building. So there were perhaps some assumptions made that someone was in the building. Maybe they weren't. Maybe someone was somewhere else. Maybe there was additional people visiting as a guest on that particular night. And it just takes a lot of, you know, auditing and going back through it, and if someone pops up that they weren't aware of, it just takes a lot of evaluating. You know, there's not a like a tally of people that went into the building, so we ever had a precise number of exactly how many people were in there. It was always an estimate, but I think now they're just phrasing it different, that it's the number of potentially unaccounted for. But it, you know, I don't know when we're gonna have a very precise number that we can hang on for, you know, for a long time.
When you've been in contact with a survivor of the Champlain South condo, what are you hearing from him and family members about their greatest needs right now?
You know, in the short term, there's a lot of concern that the remains of family members are recovered. You know, some people are in the process of and are coming to terms with the loss of life here, but there's an increased worry that will the remains of their loved ones be recovered? You know, it's not a promise, and that's not certain. So the families are really just hoping to get something that remains of their loved ones so they can perhaps do a burial or do a religious ceremony. That's where a lot of people are at this point.
I've been speaking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, who's following the latest updates on the Surfside condo collapse. Danny, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Katie.
Still to come, 5 lawsuits have now been filed on behalf of the victims and survivors of the tragedy. We're going to hear from a construction attorney. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. So far, 5 lawsuits have been filed against the Champlain Tower South Condo Board on behalf of survivors and victims' families. Forensic engineers are on the site of the condo building collapse to investigate the root causes of the catastrophe. Stuart Sobel is a construction attorney with Siegfried Rivera and Coral Gables, and he represented Miami-Dade College after one of its parking garages collapsed in 2012. Stuart joins us now. Stuart, having been involved in these construction collapses in the past, certainly none of this scale, but how long could it take for forensic engineers to really understand the root cause of the Surfside condo collapse?
Hello, Katie, and thank you for having me. It could take a while. In the case of the Miami-Dade College garage collapse, it was a fairly easy diagnosis, but it still took over a year for there to be consensus as to the cause. Here, where the diagnosis is far more complicated, I wouldn't expect it to be less than a year, maybe longer.
Well, and I want to set the stage a little bit here. When you worked on the MDC parking garage collapse in 2012, you worked with both the Miami-Dade County Judge, Michael Hansman, who is assigned now to these Surfside cases, and you also worked with an engineer that has been brought to Surfside now, Alan Kilsheimer. And what's your understanding of working with both of them and their expertise on construction law?
Well, I think the community is lucky to have each of them. In the years I've been practicing, I've seldom come across a jurist of the demeanor, knowledge, intellect, work ethic, and sympathy as Judge Hansman. I just think he is absolutely the best person for the role that he is playing. And the engineer that the city of Surfside, the town of Surfside, had foresight to hire is a man named Alan Kilsheimer. I've been fortunate to work with Mr. Kilsheimer on several big projects. He is, in my estimation, certainly the best collapse engineer expert in the country, if not the world. And bringing both of those gentlemen to this tragedy will help accelerate answers and make sure that the resolutions are as fair as they possibly can be.
And why do you say that about Kilsheimer? You know, I understand he's got a background with his experience on similar investigations. How did you work with him on those?
Well, I first met him on a project in Michigan, where I had a client that built the Detroit Lions football stadium, and Mr. Kilsheimer helped our steel fabricator client with some difficult engineering solutions that just seemed easy to him, baffling to others, easy to him. And then he was actually helping one of the contractors on the collapse of the college garage, and again was able to pinpoint, at great peril to himself, he walked a very unstable structure at the time, and took measurements and did what he does, and was able to opine as to the cause very early on, and his opinion was validated in the following months. And now he's here, and I feel better. This is my community. I live just north in Bell Harbor, and So when something like this happens and you see it on television, it's one thing, but when it's in your community, it's a whole different experience. And I am grateful for my neighbors that we have Mr. Kilsheimer and Judge Hansman shepherding us through this tragedy.
And I understand Mr. Kilsheimer was also hired by the Pentagon following 9/11. So he has extensive background in this. You know, you have said previously, Stuart, that families should wait to file lawsuits. Yet there have been 5 filed already against the Champlain Tower South Condo Board, and more are expected to be coming. From a legal perspective, what's the advantage of waiting until more information is made available?
Well, you file a suit because somebody is at fault for something. And how do you file a suit without knowing what the person or company you're suing did wrong or didn't do right? You don't know. Now, I understand the need to get in line. There's a limited amount of insurance available, from what I understand from watching Judge Hansman's hearings. I believe there's something like $48 million of property insurance available. And I understand the point of getting in line, but that money will not be divided up without the involvement of the court, without Judge Hansman overseeing it. He has already appointed Paul Singerman as a receiver. Paul Singerman is another all-star on the team that the community can thank. And so there will be time. And it just seems to me that the first order of business ought to be recovering the victims. And then there's got to be a period of time for grieving. And then you can worry about compensating you for the losses, both the personal injury and the property damage. And yes, they're enormous. But the law doesn't make you do that in the first day or first week or first month or first year. So I would prefer there to be a little bit more certainty as to what happened and who is responsible for it. This may be a combination of failings of 5 or 6 or 10 different entities. How do you point your gun without knowing who the bad guy is?
If a victim's family member or a survivor wanted to sue Miami-Dade County, for example, for responsibility in this tragedy, or town officials in Surfside, can they do that?
Well, both the county and the town enjoy what is called sovereign immunity, and it derives from the common law of England, where the saying was the king can do no wrong. And since the king can do no wrong, you can't sue the king. The government is the present embodiment of the king. It makes a lot of sense, because when you sue the government, you're really suing yourself. And if the government has to answer for everything, you will ultimately wind up having an impact on the tax base. You'll have to raise taxes, so you're taking the money out of your own pocket. That's the philosophy behind the sovereign immunity. But that has been entrenched in Florida law from the beginning, from the original Constitution. And it will prohibit suits against the county or the town of Surfside in that would second guess decisions they made. If they make bad operational decisions. So for example, if you are in a car crash at an intersection, you can't sue the county for not putting a traffic light there. But if they put a traffic light there, if they made the decision to put the traffic light there, and then they didn't maintain it, so it wasn't working, that operational level failure does subject the county or the municipality to suit. So applying that to what you have here, if there was some operational decision that an engineer told them that this building was in danger of imminent collapse, and they decided to ignore it, that might open the door. But I would be shocked, not surprised, I would be shocked if that were the case.
Well, and there's been a series of reports released that point directly to necessary repairs that the building should have done, but did not. The most explosive coming in 2018 from Morabito Consultants. How are attorneys using this information to build a negligence case against the condo association?
Well, I don't think anybody's going to have to build a negligence case against the condo association, first of all, because from what I understand, the condos insurance carriers have already advised Judge Hansman they will tender their policies. And there's nothing else to get. I mean, the condo association doesn't own the condo association owns what were the common elements, the parking garage, the swimming pool, the walkways, those things. But they don't own the individual home. And so the condo association cannot count among its assets those homes. Once the insurance company tenders its proceeds, its policy limits, then there will be very little for them to go after. But even if they could, the condo association is run by volunteer homeowners, and they face tough choices. For example, at Champlain Towers, they knew they had to make repairs, and they were in the process. Unfortunately, it is a torturously long process. First, they had to get the engineering, which costs money. What's wrong with the building? How do we fix it? And then we have to price it. So now we know what's wrong. We know what we have to do to fix it. And we get bids from contractors who will fix it. Now we have to raise that money. And how do you raise the money in a condo association? Well, you specially assess the unit owners, and that's up for a vote. Some folks who might be on a fixed income simply can't afford it, and they vote against it. So it's not so simple as saying, you know, we have some spalling here. Let's hire somebody and write a check and get it fixed. In the condo circumstance, it's far more complicated. And that for that reason, I think, this tragedy may create some new law. The legislature may act to cut down that torturous process.
I'm speaking with construction attorney Stuart Sobel of Siegfried Rivera in Coral Gables. Sobel represented Miami-Dade College after one of its parking garages collapsed in 2012. We're discussing the legal challenges ahead in Surfside as search and rescue efforts are still underway for the missing. Stuart, we know that the tower was in its process of the 40-year recertification. You mentioned that you believe this could change some laws. How do you think the recertification process could be updated to capture some of these problems sooner or be less of a long, onerous process?
Well, there's a few things. Number one, I don't think we should wait. With the advent of global warming and climate change and sea level rise, I don't think the coastal properties should wait for 40 years. It's the first 40 years, and then it's every 10 years. I think that will get cut down. Secondly, since that process was essentially championed by John Pistorino back in the day, construction investigation techniques have become much more sophisticated. So right now you have a visual inspection. Well, there's no reason other than the cost, and of course that goes back to condo living, there will be a cost, but you can take x-rays that can see the steel in the concrete. You can do all sorts of imaging. If you think about the medical profession, the imaging that has become available in the last decade or two decades, we can apply that to construction. And of course, right now it is the condo that hires the engineer. Perhaps will change things to make it like during construction, when you build a building, the county or the city makes you hire a threshold inspector to inspect the construction as it's going up. That inspector, although paid for by the developer, reports to the county or the city. Well, right now the recertification inspection is done for the condo, and perhaps the government will change that so that the duty of the inspector is directly owed to the government. Right now, if there's a circumstance that threatens life safety, is the engineer required to report the problem to the government.
Well, I'm wondering, how unique do you think that this case or these cases that emerge, will be for the company that insured Champlain Tower South? And do you think that could set a precedent for insuring condos differently in the future?
Oh, certainly. I think we've already seen the beginning of it. There have been a number of insurance companies that have required inspections as a condition of renewing policies. Underwriting will change. There may be, like post-Hurricane Andrew, higher deductibles and lower levels of coverage. Insurance companies will protect themselves from these kinds of claims. I think it may be that the legislature should mandate higher levels of insurance, because $48 million for Champlain Towers may sound like a lot of money, but when you have the potential loss of life, there's over 100 people still missing and presumed dead. There's 32 that are confirmed dead. That doesn't even count the property damage. $48 million is woefully inadequate. And if the people who are found to be at fault are either beyond the reach of the law because the statute of repose has expired, it's just too long, it's been 40 years and they're excused from anything they did 40 years ago, or if they've passed away, if they're out of business, if they have no assets, well, there's no other source of funds to compensate folks. So maybe more insurance ought to be mandated.
When you saw some condo towers, we've seen this already with Crestview in North Beach, take preemptive action, asking their residents to leave or even evicting their residents while they conduct investigations and inspections into their building. Do we expect similar actions to be taken across the state? What are the legal implications there?
Well, I think part of that is the panic reaction. I think it's natural. When you see something like this that is just not supposed to happen, the natural instinct is, well, could it happen to me? I'm right now, I'm on the 16th floor of a condominium. Could it happen to my building? And so I think that would be a healthy thing. You don't have to wait for the law to impose a recertification inspection. It is prudent if you are in a coastal environment where there is salt air and the water table is rising and you have periodic flooding, to spend some money and get an inspection and satisfy yourself so you could sleep at night that, no, it's not going to happen here.
I've been speaking with Stuart Sobel, construction attorney with Siegfried Rivera in Coral Gables. Stuart, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Katie.
Still to come, we meet a 17-year-old who's been helping maintain the Surfside Memorial site. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, in for Luis Hernandez. Directly in front of where the Surfside condo collapsed is a makeshift memorial wall. It sits along the fence of the town's tennis center. Flowers, posters, stuffed animals, other mementos sit there, placed by the victims' families and the community. The Wall of Hope and Memorial is being maintained by volunteers. 17-year-old Stephen Ferrero is the founder of the nonprofit called Helping Others and Giving Hope. He's been there almost daily since the collapse and has helped coordinate fresh flower deliveries for the memorial. He joins us now. Also joining us is Laura Sakira. She's an executive account manager with Galleria Farms, which has been donating a lot of the flowers. Welcome to you both. Stephen, you were at the site this morning. What was it like being there after the rest of the building was demolished?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on today. I mean, this morning I got here and it was just incredible. I looked into the view expecting to see the same building that was, you know, there from the beginning after the collapse, and after not being able to see it, it's incredible. It's very emotionally distraughting, and I mean, it's very sad. I couldn't imagine what these families are going through, not being able to actually re-enter their homes. It's incredible. I mean, we were able to come out this morning and, you know, give some hope and bring some support to this community, and we actually redo all the flowers that were on the memorial. We took everything that was already dying and getting after, and that's been there over a week, and I mean we redid everything. I mean, we put brand new flowers, And I mean, we beautified it. I mean, it's amazing that we had over 30 volunteers just to the community that were just there standing around, grieving and, you know, participating in the memorial. And it's just amazing we were able to do that.
When you have been there so often, what have you noticed about how people are interacting with the memorial wall?
I mean, I've been there almost every single day, and I'm not just, you know, at the memorial wall. I mean, I'm participating with the firefighters, and I mean, we're supporting them. We're also supporting the policemen and women. We've been out here just every single day, you know, providing meals, refreshments, also, you know, making sure that these survivors, you know, are staying hopeful and, you know, they're being taken care of. I mean, we're helping them provide as much as we can. I mean, even today, we've met some different community members that are actually offering homes and, you know, for them to stay up to 4 weeks. I mean, for them to stay in a brand new home where they're able to, you know, stay there for 4 weeks, where, you know, they can get their life a little together. And, you know, we want to help and make that process a lot easier. It's not easy to be out here, I'm going to be honest.
Well, Laura, I want to bring you in because for those who haven't been there or aren't familiar with what this memorial wall looks like, describe it for us. What do you see?
Hi, and once again, thank you for having me as well. What this means, and I've said it from the beginning, is these flowers basically represent that we are thinking of the victims. We are thinking of their families. We are thinking of the survivors. We have them in our prayers, even if it's a little bit of, you know, bringing some, making a difference, even with flowers. This will to make a difference into their lives by making this happen.
So we have flowers. Are there photos of the victims? What are you seeing?
So when we were doing the wall, you know, I had a vision. I was contacted by Lewis. He works with Steven as well. This was, I believe, 2 weeks ago. And he said to me, listen, we need flowers. Can you donate? And I said, of course. And I had already had a vision of, since I had seen the pictures on the wall, I wanted to put flowers, hydrangeas all over the pictures. And, you know, that's what we created. That's what Steven and I, and I believe Leo and Lewis, we made that happen.
Is there a special meaning to hydrangeas?
All flowers, and especially hydrangeas, they're, you know, they're meant to brighten, and they mean life. Our company is basically where we represent, we're the main growers of hydrangeas. We go by create emotions. Now, what's going on right now, you know, we want to give some type of comfort, even if it's flowers. We want to bring comfort through our flowers for the victims and their families.
And the color, hydrangeas are beautiful.
Green.
Yes. Steven, take me to that moment when you heard about what happened in Surfside. Where were you at the time, and what did you think? What drove you to say, I need to do something?
I mean, I had waken up that morning. I mean, I went to bed at around 1:32 in the morning that same night. And it's incredible. You know, I never saw anything. I hadn't gone on social media. I mean, I was just laying in bed watching TV and, you know, just relaxing. And I mean, I woke up the next morning to my mom telling me, hey, a building collapsed last night at 1:30 in the morning. I woke up and I go, no way. So I go on social media. I had seen, I mean, everything. It was a disaster. It was a tragedy in general. I had seen so many pictures and videos of what was going on, and that was just everywhere globally. And immediately I had thought of doing something, and, you know, I kept thinking, what can I do? As, you know, it is something that wasn't an open site at the moment. It was, you know, something very closed, as, you know, they had police, they had the firefighters, they had everyone trying to see how many people they can get out as the scene was going on. And I immediately, you know, as I let the day go on, and when the day went on and around the noonish time, I had noticed, you know, I need to get involved. So I made the change. I made the calls. I called several of my friends and families and people that I work with, you know, my partners for my nonprofit. And I immediately told them, hey, I need your help. You know, can we make this happen today within the next hour? And we had donors from, you know, Carla Bakery, ready to go. We also had Miami Diaper Bank ready to go. We came out here immediately and dropped off, I mean, supplies that we went and bought. So, I mean, it's incredible. We were able to go ahead and, you know, bring over hundreds of dollars of supplies. I mean, Carla Bakery donated thousands of pastries that within hours we were out here. Miami Beach Police helped us out, get into the scene and drop them off. And within the next day, we were back. We were back with that same day, next day with Sports Crew. I mean, it's incredible. It's just, you know, it's insane how these things react and how things change. And the little calls, you know, I made simple calls, you know, I would never have expected the reaction I got from these people saying, hey, yes, we're interested. Let's make that happen. When do you need it by? You understand what I mean? It's like, it's crazy how, you know, you have so many supporters and how many people have united to make just a little bit of hope and a lot of hope that people are being able to have from what we're doing.
Well, and Stephen, you know, besides the memorial wall, you mentioned your nonprofit has also been providing food and drinks for the rescue teams, first responders on the site. I want to keep in mind, you're 17 years old. What drives you to spend your time, you know, putting your effort into your nonprofit, your summer, doing this work to help other people?
I mean, I'm 17 and, you know, I've been doing this for about 2 years now. Even before that, I was doing this. And it was just, you know, my parents have always taught me, you know, hey, you have to give back. You know, they didn't have as much as I do at the moment. I mean, I'm very blessed, I can tell you that. My parents have been able to, you know, maintain a job. Even throughout the pandemic, they were able to maintain a job. And they've been able to provide me a lot of things that a lot of kids don't have. And, you know, I was very blessed and I got very encouraged. And I mean, I immediately set up my own nonprofit after doing a couple of my own events. You know, I said I need to do more. And with my nonprofit, I was able to do more. And I mean, I've been very honored to go ahead and, you know, get involved very, very closely with, you know, Miami-Dade Fire Rescue. And, you know, I've been able to be recognized by a lot of people. And it's just amazing how the community comes together, not just, you know, to help those that are in need and, you know, but also unite and, you know, bring hope to others.
I'm speaking with Stephen Ferreiro. He's the founder of the nonprofit called Helping Others and Giving Hope. Also with us, Laura Sakira, who is an executive account manager with Galleria Farms, which has been donating flowers to help maintain this makeshift memorial wall in front of where the Surfside condo collapse happened. You can find photos of the memorial wall, more information about the organizations on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Laura, I want to bring you back in because Surfside is a really small community and there are so many people connected to this tragedy in South Florida outside of Surfside. How have you seen those connections and been impacted? How have you been impacted by this catastrophe?
Now, I have been talking to a lot of people that, you know, that they know we were involved with the wall, and it has brought the community together. It has brought people just reaching out and wanting to help, being there. Because putting a lot of people have basically put themselves in that situation, and it has affected emotionally, I would say. And they want to donate to the victims. They want to donate to the first responders. I have seen a change, a drastic change in the community. People have been, it has brought them closer.
You've been speaking with victims, family members, both of you, in the creation of this memorial wall. Laura, how do you see those victims, family members keeping up their hope?
Basically by the first responders and I'm sorry, the amount of people involved that they have been there, giving them comfort through words, actions, and, you know, like Stephen, for example, that he has been there talking to the victims. They have kept their hope alive because they have seen how those first responders have been there nonstop, working day and night, trying to get answers for them and working to find their loved ones.
And you've done flower donations in the past, Laura, for other charitable causes. Is this time different for you?
It is, because we have never donated, you know, for a tragedy like this. We do Goodwill, kids that foster kids, Joe DiMaggio, St. Jude's, Boys and Girls Clubs. And my Boys and Girls Clubs are actually my charity of choice that I work with. And I have never experienced this. You know, I've seen it happen, but never have I been involved like I have right now.
Well, and Stephen, in doing this work, you've been in close proximity with those working at the site. What have you been hearing from rescue teams and the first responders you've been in contact with?
I mean, I've asked several times to these first responders and rescue teams, especially the task force. I mean, we've had task force from all around the world. Here today we have Illinois, Louisiana, we've had New Jersey. You know, I've spoken to them directly today, and, you know, I've asked them, what's the next step? When are you guys going into the next step? You know, is it just going to be search and rescue, as, you know, or is it just going to be the next step? Or we're going to recovery mode? He goes, no, there's no recovery mode. We're only going to do search and rescue. And that's what our job is. And, you know, we have hope, you know, there's still people alive. And I mean, I've been telling that to several family members. I mean, so many people have asked me, what are they saying? And I'm telling you, these guys are motivated, these women and men. I've seen them tirelessly going from 12-hour shifts, wanting to continue going. These firefighters and first responders are not going to stop. I mean, they are. I mean, I'm here today, and I'm right at the moment I'm actually here. And I mean, all you see is movement, and the movement is that they are just working to find every single person they can to make sure that, you know, they bring closures, but they believe in finding people alive. And I mean, and I believe it too. You know, I think there's hope for those that are still unaccounted for. And I tell those family members every time I see them, have hope. You know, I'm praying for them, and a lot of people are praying for them. And I know these firefighters are going to bed every night whenever they can, praying for them. And I mean, it's hit emotionally everyone. It's not just, you know, those around us, but even the firefighters. Emotionally, they've been hurt. You know, it's amazing.
Well, do you think that having this memorial wall, the flowers, the photos of the victims, do you see that comforting the first responders as well?
I can tell you that in some ways, yes. And in some ways, you know, it does emotionally show them, you know, there's people, you know, there's people actually still working, that they're working towards, you know. I think it shows them there's a goal of, you know, and there's hope. You know, so many people actually have, you know, actually not just us, have been out there putting flowers, that it gives them, you know, some source of hope and joy. You know, I've grieved myself. I have no one that's unaccounted for and that's been in this building. But I mean, there's so many people that are, and, you know, I've been able to grieve with those firefighters from different parts of the state and, you know, different parts of the countries, you know. And I mean, even it's just amazing, you know, in a way that, you know, we've been able to unite. We've been able to not just, you know, only come together, but, you know, relate in a way that there's some sense of hope. And I believe, you know, these firefighters are definitely not getting affected by that. I think that it's just motivating them, you know, to have some more hope.
Laura, you know, while we have to wrap up here, I want to ask you, you've been able to beautify the memorial a couple of times with new flowers now. What are the plans for the future of this memorial?
Now, that's something that Stephen and I were actually talking about this morning. We want to do something, not just for the victims, but do something for the first responders, not just basically the wall itself, but do something for them to thank them. And my plans is basically keep it up, keep on, you know, I don't plan on stopping with the flowers. I don't plan on just letting it be. No, I just want to, I got the approval to just every week get boxes of flowers and donate them, because this is something that, you know, it's just not going to go away. No, I don't think
we could talk about this for so much longer.
Right.
It's such a beautiful thing that you both are doing. I'd like to thank our guests, Stephen Fedato, the founder of the nonprofit called Helping Others and Giving Hope, and Laura Sakira. She's an executive account manager with Galleria Farms. Thank you both for sharing this with us.
No, thank you for having us.
You can find photos of the memorial wall and more information about the nonprofit on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Tuesday, July 6th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we'll hear from an engineering expert from FIU about what new details have been uncovered that could point to the cause of the Surfside collapse. How could the investigation by forensic engineers change how buildings are inspected and constructed for years to come in South Florida? Plus, we'll hear from the organizations engaged in fundraising efforts for the family members of the victims and the survivors. As money continues to pour in, they'll explain how that's being spent and where resources are still needed. A reminder, we'll continue to monitor Hurricane Elsa, Tropical Storm Elsa, as it continues to travel westward along the Florida Keys north. We'll continue to update you on All Things Considered this afternoon. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.